Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Hamas on Monday said it had freed two Israeli women as U.S. troops in Syria came under fire again from Iran-backed militias.
Two one-way attack drones taking down, no injuries to U.S. forces. We know that these groups are groups that are backed by Iran.
Zimbabweans hope to benefit from their country's diamond industry. Zambia's main opposition Patriotic Front Party suspends several prominent members. Nigeria's Supreme Court has begun hearing the challenge to President Bola Tinubu's election victory. A rights group says Nigeria recorded more than 800 extrajudicial executions in 3 years.
What you have seen is the extraction of the number of people who have died through extrajudicial killings. And those are the list numbers. Those are the numbers that we're able to verify.
And Malawi makes first large-scale wheat harvest. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Hamas on Monday said it had freed two Israeli women who were among the more than 200 hostages taken during its October 7 campaign in southern Israel, while sources said the U.S. had advised Israel to hold off on a ground assault in the Gaza Strip. According to Reuters, a spokesperson for the armed wing of the Palestinian Hamas militant group was quoted as saying the group decided to release the hostages for humanitarian and poor health grounds. Meanwhile, the United States is bracing for what senior defense and military officials describe as a significant escalation as the war between Israel and Hamas enters its third week. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon.
Latest incident targeted the Antaf garrison in southern Syria.
Two one-way attack drones taken down, no injuries to U.S. forces.
Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Patrick Ryder says all signs point to Tehran.
We know that these groups are groups that are backed by Iran.
The U.S. says it has not seen intelligence to suggest Iran issued any direct orders, but that it will hold Tehran responsible.
We're going to continue to do what we need to do to protect and safeguard our forces.
This is the second time in as many weeks that Antamp has been targeted. A drone attack last week caused minor injuries. On Saturday, the Pentagon announced it's bolstering its forces in the Middle East, sending a second carrier strike group to the region, along with a THAAD anti-ballistic missile defense system and multiple Patriot missile defense systems. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
International human rights group Global Rights says Nigeria has recorded more than 800 incidents of extrajudicial killings across the country in the last 3 years. The report says more than 120 of the victims were killed in the first half of this year alone, and that many Nigerians are living in fear of brutality from law enforcement agencies. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The recent release of the Mass Atrocities Casualties Report by the nonprofit Global Rights Group coincided with the third year remembrance of the victims of police brutality in Nigeria. According to the report, 848 extrajudicial executions took place in Nigeria between 2020 and June 2023. The report said 127 cases happened in the first half of this year alone. The human rights group said Nigerian citizens have been living in fear of brutality from law enforcement agents as a result. Abiodun Bayewu is the executive director of Global Rights.
Since 2018, where we have kept a tab on the mass atrocities across Nigeria. So it cuts across issues like casualties of terrorist attacks, cold killings, communal clashes, extrajudicial killings. What you have seen is the extraction of the number of people who have died through extrajudicial killings. And those are the list numbers. Those are the numbers that we're able to verify.
Bayewu says authorities must be held accountable.
We seem to be running round about the same figures every year, with the exception of 2020 and 2022. But then when you think about 127 people killed in the first half of 2023, and you think of the number of officers who have been sanctioned for these killings, then you know we're still very, very way off from the way things need to be dealt with.
The riots group said 271 and 253 people were killed in 2020 and 2022, respectively, the highest numbers in the period reviewed. Thousands across Nigeria marched in October 2020 in protests known as the NSARS movement against the activities of the now disbanded Special Anti-Robbery Squad, a unit accused of police brutality, including torture, killings, and extortion. The protests went on for days until security forces cracked down on demonstrators at the Lekki toll gate in Lagos. Global Rights report said 123 people were killed. Nigerian authorities deny the numbers but promised to investigate and punish offenders. Aminu Hayatu is a conflict and crisis researcher at Amnesty International. Hayatu says despite the government often denying casualty numbers, an attempt by Lagos state authorities in July to bury more than 100 people who died during the protests gives credence to the claims.
There are a lot of issues that are happening underground which are not visible in the public space. This is a semblance of the truth of the matter. Amnesty International has written letters to the Lagos state government to really conduct an investigation and bring out a report and respond to these allegations.
Amnesty initially said only 12 protesters were killed at the toll gate. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The Supreme Court of Nigeria has begun hearing the challenge to President Bola Tinubu's election victory. The court is also expected to decide whether to accept Tinubu's education documents presented by lawyers of former Vice President Atiku Abubakar. They allege in their argument that the president did not present credible documentation to the Independent National Electoral Commission, also known as INEC, to contest in the recent general election. INEC declared Tinubu the winner of the contest, but both former Vice President Abubakar and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi rejected the outcome. An election petition tribunal, a lower court, upheld the president's victory, but the president's opponents appealed to the Supreme Court. For analysis, viewers Peter Clutter reached Ibrahim Momo, a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
This is about the presidency. And the way the courts have gone about it today, they required before now to file the application before now. Today was merely for them to adopt their written application. And then immediately after the adoption, the Supreme Court has now reserved judgment and has told the parties that they're going to communicate with them the day of the judgment. So it's going to be a very swift process, if you need.
Their report of all eyes on the Supreme Court has this gripped the nation, Nigeria, as we speak at the moment.
When you say all eyes are on the Supreme Court or the judiciary, that's actually the case because it is the final lap in the entire electoral process. Whatever the Supreme Court rules is final. So everybody is interested. You know, with the Court of First Instance, the Presidential Election Petition Tribunal, which is the Court of Appeal, whoever lost out there could also appeal. But at the Supreme Court, it's a different ballgame. It's the court of final jurisdiction.
Ibrahim, there are suggestions that recent information or evidence gotten by Atiku should be presented to the court as well to see whether the president was qualified in the first place or not. The Supreme Court is supposed to adjudicate on that too. How are Nigerians reacting to this?
Well, you know, this issue happened today. What happened is that the lawyers for the president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu and the APC, are arguing against the appeal filed by the opposition parties on several grounds. One, they're saying that the time allowed for these exercises, 180 days, has since elapsed since the filing of the case. It's over 180 days. Another thing that they are saying is that the deposition that Atiku is relying on was filed in the private chambers of, I think, the judge, not necessarily in an open court, and does not meet the criteria for admissibility. So the Nigerians are still waiting to get there because, you know, this candidate did very well in the last election, whether it was the winning candidate, as it were, the current president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, or the candidate that came second and third, the Atiku Abubakar of the PDP and Peter Obi of the Labour Party, they did it on a very tight, very close outcome. So they have across board a large following. So they expect that their followers are waiting with bated breath to know what the Supreme Court is going to rule or how it's going to rule. And so there's a lot of apprehension among supporters of the various parties to be sued fairly at the Supreme Court.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 24. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. UN peacekeepers in Mali on Monday left their camp in the tense Kidal region under a withdrawal order by the troubled country's military leaders, UN and local sources said. The pullout of the UN Stabilization Mission, also known as MINUSMA, has ignited fears that fighting will intensify between troops and armed factions for control of the territory. On Sunday, the mission announced it had accelerated its departure the day before from the Tessalit camp in an extremely tense and degraded security context that endangered the lives of its personnel. Monday's withdrawal is the second in the Kidal region and the seventh in the country. Zimbabwe has natural resources that include nearly 40 different minerals and one of the world's largest deposits of diamonds. Yet, the vast majority of Zimbabweans continue to live in poverty. Columbus Mavunga visits the country's famous Marenge diamond fields and talks with residents who want average people to benefit more from the country's mineral wealth.
The Marenge fields of Zimbabwe is home to one of the world's largest diamond deposits. The precious gems were first mined here in 2006. The government-owned Zimbabwe Consolidated Diamond Company says it is working to increase production so that all citizens can reap the benefits of mining the gems, according to spokesman Sugar Chagwanda.
And I'm sure we are doing this by way of making sure that we contribute to community development, be it in terms of employing locals, also infrastructure development, sport and recreation, as well as general amenities, which is quite good. And we are also extending to the province. Ultimately, the idea is to make sure that the diamonds, they benefit the entire country, which is also in sync with the vision of the government.
But the benefits have yet to reach people living nearby, says resident Atro Mshangwiza, who has lived near the Marenge fields his whole life. In this diamond mining area, there is a problem, Mshangwiza says. Children are missing school because their parents are failing to pay fees. He says, we hope that the diamonds can benefit the local children more through schools in the diamond mining area by reducing fees or paying their fees. That's our major concern, so the children have a great future. Zimbabwe Consolidated Diamond Company says it has started building schools with science labs to improve local children's education. But schooling isn't the only problem that Zimbabweans want diamonds to solve. They say the industry should help the economy more. The problem is that the sector lacks transparency, says Center for Natural Resource Governance Director Farai Maguru.
The diamond sector is now subject to extreme organized crime, and the leaders are the only ones who know where the diamonds are going, how the diamonds are leaving the country, where the revenues are going. But as a citizenry, we have been completely disconnected and cut out from any information regarding the diamond industry.
Getting that information would be one way to help Zimbabwe follow the example of Botswana, whose booming economy is largely built on diamonds, according to economist Prosper Chitambaram with the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe.
The second one being a beneficiation of those minerals. In other words, moving up the value chain through an industrialization-based process. So I think those two factors are important in terms of ensuring that the ordinary citizen actually gets to benefit from those resources.
Currently, Zimbabwe ranks a distant seventh in worldwide diamond production, despite having diamond fields roughly the size of Luxembourg. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Marange, Zimbabwe.
Zambia's main opposition Patriotic Front, PF party, has announced the suspension of several prominent members for carrying out activities that the party says undermine unity and brought the group into disrepute. Those affected include three members of parliament and the national chairman of the party, Davis Chama, and parliamentarian Miles Sampa. Sampa is threatening to hold a competing general conference under the Patriotic Front, a move that the leaders of the party say is illegal. For more on the suspensions, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Rafael Nasinda, the general secretary of the Patriotic Front.
They have brought the name of the party into disrepute, and to that effect, there have been allegations, petitions against their standing within the party. And yesterday, having held the Central Committee meeting, those members, as matters were brought to Central Committee, and for purposes of upholding the norms and ethics and procedures of the party, they were asked to step aside by way of them being suspended from all party activities or indeed any participation on their part in party activities until such a time that the disciplinary processes are concluded. That is the decision that was made yesterday.
What's the next step after this suspension? Because there are suggestions that it's too sudden and it's too abrupt. So how do you explain to the population or your supporters about why the Central Committee or the party decided to take this decision?
I'd be surprised if anybody said it is too sudden and people are not aware, because the activities of these colleagues have been in public domain. The only thing that has hindered or has created an impression that we have been very slow at taking action is the fact that there is always a demand within our strategy for us to follow the cause of natural justice. And to that effect, disciplinary procedures needed to be followed and adhered to strictly. Otherwise, the membership across the country has been demanding that for purposes of preserving unity and discipline within the party, that swift action should be taken against these members. It has taken us this long for us to arrive at this decision because of the internal processes that were being undertaken. Of course, some of these processes we were not pronouncing publicly because it wasn't necessary, because we needed to give an opportunity for these colleagues to be heard. The only reason why it was necessary to make a pronouncement yesterday is because the general public and the membership across the country needed to know that by virtue of these suspensions, these colleagues are precluded from participating in party activities.
Nakachinda, what do you say to those who are of the view that perhaps a reconciliation move or having a dialogue with some of these, your members, in order to try to right the wrongs or alleged wrongs they have committed, in order to have a form of unity, because politics in Zambia is by numbers, and having these people in your ranks who have been members for a long time really serve a significant purpose?
First of all, reconciliation and dialogue, and making sure that in whatever action we take, we don't cross a line in infringing on people's democratic right to express themselves, or indeed to undertake activities that they have the right and freedom to do, is not infringed upon.
Rafael Nakashinda is the General Secretary of Zambia's main opposition Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. Malawi has made its first successful large-scale harvest of wheat after years of attempts to find a variety of grain suitable for its soil. Wheat farming is seen as a solution to mitigate the impact of the Russia-Ukraine conflict on grain imports to the African continent. Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
Ronald Nguira is the chief executive officer of Malawi registered U.S. company Pixas Agriculture Limited, which operates a farm in central Malawi for the diversification of wheat seeds. Nguira said about four varieties of wheat have so far been found suitable for Malawian soil out of about 80 varieties which had been tried since 2019. Speaking during the start of the first large-scale harvest over the weekend, Nguira said the wheat farming will help Malawi save millions of dollars spent on wheat imports.
Malawi imports 200,000 tons of wheat, $48 million. If we are to get there, it could take us 4 years to produce enough wheat in Malawi to satisfy ourselves. Because 4 years might seem like a long time, but we are already there and we'll have the seed available.
Agriculture experts in Malawi say wheat farming is expected to produce about 90 metric tons, which is 50% of the country's wheat consumption. Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera witnessed the harvest Friday at Impale Farm in Lower District. He says wheat farming can enable Malawians to be self-sustaining, but this will require each one of us to achieve the desired results. Let us all make a move toward that goal by even using modern technology. Malawi has long heavily dependent on imported wheat, and the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine has disrupted food supply chains. According to the United Nations, Africa takes about 12.26% of grain imported from Ukraine. A UN report notes that the Russian invasion of Ukraine triggered a shortage of about 30 million tons of grain on the continent, along with a sharp increase in cost. Wisdom Gomezulu is an agricultural economist and lecturer at Malawi University of Business and Applied Sciences.
If we can find markets, then I think it can be another source of forex in the country. Because as you know, wheat is one of those high-value cash crops that is highly demanded in the world.
Gomezulu said to achieve this, Malawi needs to find more sustainable production technologies that can give a comparative advantage, considering that there are already big players in the market.
We need more investment in research. Let's look for more funds and more donor partners to finance agronomists and other scientists that are actually maybe trying their best to breed varieties that can actually be grown here in Malawi. But for that to be done, we need more research, we need more investment, and maybe get a share on the export market.
In the meantime, Nguira of Pixas say they are planning to plant 15,000 hectares of seed in December to prepare farmers for mass wheat production next year. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Over 30 people, likely including students from neighboring Chad, have been kidnapped by suspected bandits in northern Cameroon. The mayor of the local town of Tuboro said on Monday. Mayor Celestin Yoda told Reuters the kidnapping took place on Sunday evening. A Cameroonian security source confirmed the incident without giving details and said it was believed to be kidnapping for ransom, which is common in the area, rather than a militant attack. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botti in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.